My name's Paul Tolley, and it's time for Community Spotlight. And our guest this morning is James White, local resident, local artist. And we're going to talk with James about growing up in the area, and particularly about becoming an artist, learning art, and his art practice. Good morning, James.
Morning, Paul.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. So I guess we start at the beginning. You were raised, I guess, in the broader area, in Boggabri, on a farm.
Yes, yes. We had in the 50s, it was fairly isolated. Dad had a mixed farm which he acquired from his mother, and it was initially just a grazing place because in the old days grazing was the go. And then he turned it into a farming grazing enterprise, and that was about it. It was fairly isolated. I can remember when the telephone came, when the power came, when the road was eventually graded by the council. So prior to that, it was pretty basic.
But both those things would have reduced the sense of isolation, I guess.
Very much so. I can remember when the 240 power came, the electricians came and wired the house, and we were watched in fascination as the electricians decided which switch might drive which light. We thought, oh, isn't that amazing?
Did that give you radio, for example?
We'd always had radio. It was 2NU Tamworth and 2GL Glen Innes, and they were the local stations, and that's one thing we did have, because it was years before television came. Mm.
So you're on the farm. You've got a very visual surrounding, but a rural surrounding. How did you start out? What told you you were interested in art? Did you just pick up a pencil and a piece of paper and start drawing your surroundings?
Well, how did that begin? There were three brothers, mum and dad, and lots of dogs and cats, obviously. But at a very early stage, mum realised that I had the ability to draw easily. And I can remember in my youth just drawing anything. But mum was rather an inventive person, and she could see that I needed encouraging. So she would buy me how to draw books. And I can remember drawing flowers, and they were always, and in watercolour, that was when I was probably eight or something. And it just was something which I did. But it was through mum's encouragement that I was pushed, because I didn't have the brains to decide to do it myself. I just did what she told me.
At that age. So you've just said something interesting, because your primary area of practice is watercolour, but you first tried watercolours around the age of eight.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I remember once, because mum was a very good gardener, and she must have given me watercolours. I don't remember that, but I can still remember she had a very special rose and a specimen jar, which was what they had in those days. And I can still see this beautiful pink single-bloomed rose in this specimen jar, and it was done in watercolour, and it was fairly credible from my memory. So, yes, I was using watercolour and drawing.
And were you one of those kids? I mean, I remember a couple, I never had the skill or facility when I was at school, who would pick up a pencil and draw a caricature of a teacher, or had the ability to just create humorous images.
Oh, I was never that clever. I always classify. I always say I'm not very imaginative, but I'm very skillful. And they say, "Oh no, that's not true. That's not true." But I was an incredible copyist, and I can remember when we were organising social functions, I'd be the one who'd draw the cartoon characters on the invitation, and so they said, "Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic." But I didn't design them myself. I wasn't that clever.
So your mother very much encouraged you. You were drawing, and you had taken up watercolours, probably because she provided you with the wherewithal to do that.
Yes.
You painted the rose. Were you primarily, because I saw a recent exhibition of yours at Naram, and there were a lot of flowers.
Yes.
Has that been a constant through?
No, it hasn't. What happens with art making is artists have a theme, have an idea, and once the idea or the theme starts, it just feeds itself, and one painting feeds to the next, feeds to the next. And so in that instance, I had been doing the still life style, which was created in the Baroque period in Amsterdam, in Holland. And I loved the hideously dark background and the colourful flowers. Now, when the Dutch were painting those, it was in an era when the merchants had become very wealthy with their trading, and they actually were commissioning artists to paint these flower studies. But they weren't flower studies. They were actually images which replicated the success of the merchants. They weren't portraits, but they were different flowers represented different aspects of their life. Some was success, some was fecundity, some was death. And so it went on, and I just like that notion because it was just more than a still life. But then what was also happening with watercolours was that the use of the very dark background made the flowers stand out more.
Just
made,
pop.
Made them come forward. And so prior to that, I was painting shearing sheds, and I did that for a couple of years because I was obsessed with the notion of the structure of the sheds and the classification that these buildings were cathedrals of Australia. They're rural edifices which are just unbelievable. They're not just a shearing shed. They're something which is really quite special. Of course, it replicates the Australian rural industries, but these shearing sheds are really quite something else. Prior to that, I've done a lot of European painting, Greek and Italian, and so the exhibitions vary from one year to the next, well, from one theme to the next, and at the moment I'm still working on flowers.
And going back to talking about the European influence on you, this was a time, of course, which probably has passed, when both in music and in art, the rise of the merchant class meant that there was patronage for the great musicians and the great great artists, and, and they would have a patron, and that would provide the livelihood.
Well, I didn't have a patron, but
only
I was heavily encouraged to paint watercolours with Rupert Richardson from Baraba, who's another very well known local artist, and he and I got on well, and I used to go to workshops on under his tutelage.
So, and you were also influenced, I understand, by one of the great Australian artists, Fred Roberts. What was it about Roberts that appealed to you?
My art is fairly traditional. It's representational. It's easy to understand. There's nothing curly about it. But I like reality, but I like reality which is vaguely distorted. When the Australian Impressionists came along, they were creating an impression of what was their subject matter. And for me, just a pure still life or a landscape didn't cut the mustard. So I tried to bend the rules a little bit. And so when the Impressionists came, if we look at them, they've got rainy afternoons with the suggestion of wet streets and incredibly hot landscapes with really strong sunburnt colours and things. And they're telling a story, not so much just what was happening, but what they were trying to say with their artworks. So that came later on in my life, though. Initially, I was pretty pedestrian.
But that's what you took from Roberts, in a sense, that school of Australian art. And they were also trying to talk about and show images of Australia, because there'd been a period earlier than that when the artists were just still painting as though they were in England.
Yes, the Australian Impressionists, for the first time, realised the Australian light was very special, terribly strong, very bright, which was not a European concept. And so their skies were washed out and hot, and the grasses were yellow ochre and burnt, and the shadows were strong. And this was an all indication of just saying, this is what Australia is like in the landscape format.
So I saw the recent exhibition at Naram. I saw an exhibition a little before that, I think, down in Tamworth of your work. And one of the things I noticed was the use of light and the contrast with the dark. So you found this, you took this out of the Impressionists, and it was something I guess you saw growing up out west.
I was always intrigued with how accurate I could draw things. For example, doing the shearing sheds, all the rafters had to be done properly, all the perspective had to be done properly. But in lots of instances, it's things you don't necessarily realise what's happening. For example, the light is something which is in everything. And I can remember when I was learning art when I was at school, the art teacher would say, which side is the sun? which would say the light must come from one side of the artwork. I said, right. So in that instance, I've always been aware of shadows. And then when I became an art educator, we had to teach early young artists how art was held together. And there were components called elements of art. They may well have changed nowadays, but the five basic ones was the lines associated in an artwork, the colour, obviously, the texture, which was, you know, how you could make things feel textured, the tone and something else, line shape, tone, colour, texture, the other five. Anyhow, the one which I have used the greatest effect is the tone, the light tone and the dark tone. And people often say, you know, how did you make it look like that? And I said, well, obviously the colour's there and the drawing is there as the basis, but it's the way the dark tones make the subject matter appear more prominent. And so for me, tone is absolutely everything. And when I'm doing an artwork and thinking, is this working? I said, it needs more tone. It needs more light from one side and dark from the other side. And in doing that process, it creates a form in the artwork. So it's more rounded. The image is coming forward. And it just makes it more appealing, I hope.
And that probably gives you the opportunity for the slight distortion that you mentioned.
Well,
earlier.
The distortion I did years ago when I travelled a lot in Europe.
We'll get there in a minute. Actually, hold that thought. But I was actually going to say my background is in film production, and we talk in very similar terms. And of course, without light, there's no exposure of the film.
Of course, really,
you're always painting in inverted commas with light. So, before we go overseas, at some stage you left the farm, and you did some travelling, didn't you?
No, well, education was a real issue. We, the five of us and all the other farmers' children, went to a bush school, and that was just 3 miles down the road, and there were a sum total of 15 children. That was it. That was a big year. In my year, there was two, myself and Gary. And Gary lived across the road on another farm. The teacher, this is just to put some primary school education, the teacher was a retired teacher who had been pulled out of the retirement because of the shortage of teachers during the war. So he was our teacher. That was Charlie Young. Charlie Young was old and grumpy, and he lived, the school was set in about 10 acres of bush and surrounded by farming paddocks. Charlie lived in a fly tent in the bush, and he cooked on an open fire, and we thought that was normal. And it was just, in retrospect, absolutely bizarre. But that was
primitive.
Very, very primitive. But that was our education. We learnt our times tables, we did rounders, we did tunnel ball, we marched.
Both you and Gary, two of you.
And the other 13 students. It was just incredible. I don't know how he taught everyone. One teacher school. So the notion of secondary education was a real problem because of the isolation. And from Boggle Bri, it had a school, but it wasn't a very flash one. Gunnedah, I think, only had a central school. Tamworth was the closest school for finishing your leaving certificate, which involved boarding. And the next option was Armidale, and it involved boarding, so we went to Taz. And that was, you know, back in the late 50s, it was a pretty ordinary school too. The teachers they'd all been shot in the war. There was none left, so all these poor old things were coming along teaching us stuff, and they were English-orientated. We had some terrible teachers. We had some fantastic teachers.
Did you get any art encouragement at Taz?
There was no art taught at school. And so Mum said, why don't you take art lessons after school? And I said, yeah, that's okay. I didn't know why. And so we had a teacher who came in who used to teach at the Teachers College. And I can't remember his name, Fred.
Well, I'll take you to 1964, and you won the watercolour prize at the Currabubula Arts.
I won a watercolour, not the watercolour. I might have, I don't know. But so when I left school, I had acquired easy art-making skills. I realised I could do it without any effort after having been shown by the teacher. And so I left school in 1963, not very glorious, and entered Currabubbera Art Show in 1964 with stuff I suppose I'd painted at school, I don't know. And I've been exhibiting ever since.
And you've won it 6 times.
Well, I've won it a number of times. I don't sort of sprout that, but it's been very successful. Good for selling places and selling artworks. And it was one of the very first charity art shows which has remained successful after all these years, 60 years I think it is. And lots of other communities replicated the process. We had charity shows all over the Northwest, which I used to attend and exhibit. And so Currabubbera still goes. Oh, Bendemeer has them. Nundle has them. So they do exist. But things are a bit different nowadays with art sales, which drive these things. The sales of money is what goes to the charity. But the digital replication of art and selling online is a much bigger process now.
And one of the interesting things, I guess, to comment on now that we've reached a point in your life where you are painting and exhibiting and selling work, is that you're a male artist doing watercolours, which is perhaps less common, isn't it?
Oh, very much so. The watercolour notion was as a result of having workshops with Rupert Richardson from Baraba.
And your mother's, I guess,
well, yes. She was a frustrated artist too, I think. But what was interesting with watercolours was that you got results instantly. An artwork could be done in a couple of hours, as compared with oils. Acrylics didn't exist then. Well, they weren't popular. But with oil painting, it was messy. It took ages to dry. It was smelly, and you had to be careful carrying it around. And so I leant towards watercolours because, first of all, very few people were doing them because oils were the most prominent media, and I can get results quickly. So that's how that came about.
And one of the things in your work, there's a lot of very pale watercolour you work. Your colours really pops. You have a technique that allows you to get an intensity in your coloration, which is perhaps unusual in watercolour.
There are artists who can replicate that intense colour, but probably one of the interesting areas is that the quality of art from a watercolour tube is, if it's an artist's quality, it does have incredible intensity of colour. You go down then to Coatman, I think, and it's less intense, it's cheaper. Then you go to student colours, and they are nowhere near as expensive, but they still work. But they just don't create the colours like the artist quality paints.
So you've left school, you've moved to Tas and Armidale. You then did quite a bit of travelling. When you were overseas, I mean, you talked about the Dutch masters earlier in that period. Was that part of the motivation? Did you paint and draw overseas, or did you just do the Australian, the young Australian, European tour?
When we left school, we had very few options. You could go to university. Well, that was knocked on the head because I didn't get qualifications for that. You could go to Tech College, which is now TAFE, or you could go back on the land or become a tradie. And so Mum said, well, what are you going to do now? And I only had half a brain, so I said, I don't know. She said, how about becoming a wool class? I said, yep, that'll do. So I went to Tamworth Tech College, and we did stage 2 wool classing, and I became a wool classer. And so for the next 3 years, I travelled around Queensland and Western Australia in shearing sheds. And as a result of that, I was well paid. I was pretty tight with money, so I didn't spend it, didn't drink. So that saved a lot. And so I met a guy in Western Australia who said, we should go overseas together. And I said, that's a good idea. And I had all this money. And then he pulled the pin. So I said, oh, well, I'll go by myself. And this is in the late 60s. And going overseas was like a rites of passage, nearly. Mm. We travelled and travelled all over Europe. The Australians, the South Africans and the New Zealanders were excellent travellers. And so I just left by myself, sailed to England, stopping off at South Africa and Rhodesia as it was then, and just one foot in front of the other, But I had no real knowledge of art at all. No art history, no art training, except I knew I could paint. And so in Europe, I still hadn't hit the straps as far as what art represented. But I had 2 years there and travelled extensively. And then before I returned, because my eldest brother was back on the farm by then, I said to Mum and Dad, I think I'll stay in Sydney and do some art lessons. And Mum said, yeah, that's fine. They're terribly accommodating. So I did a year in Sydney and took art lessons and found a wife, which was even better, and then came back on the farm. And so back on the farm with a bit of art training, but a wife who said, you need to do more of this. So that's how it started. So that was how the process of being a farmer and painting really got together. I used to work on the farm during the day and then paint at night.
And it's absolutely true, isn't it? I mean, I'm not an artist at all, not a visual artist anyway. I work in film and photography, mm-hmm. but you get better by doing it, don't you?
Oh, gosh, yes. And as you get older, you acquire more skills, more control, and eventually you get to the stage where you can literally produce what's in your head. You know the pitfalls, you know where it's going wrong, and you modify it, and if it's not right, give it the flick and do it again. But by the stage I'm at now, I can just about control the output, which is good.
So you talk about what's in your head. Do you have a preference for painting from memory over painting an object in front of you?
I take a lot of... Well, when I travelled, I painted overseas in a sketchbook, and I took a lot of photographs, and I now work a lot from photographs as reference material. And if, for example, I'm doing one now, which is an extension of the ones I've been doing, of flowers and things, and I know basically what I want. I know flowers well because my wife and I were very good gardeners. And so I keep sketching this idea until it feels right. And I put something in and say, oh, that's the wrong place. So you move it around a bit, then it needs something here, and then that colour's wrong there. So the process of putting it together is a bit of hit and miss, but in that stage it's in my imagination. But all the time I'm referring back to, you know, the colour of a certain rose, or how a petal is formed, and what stamens they've got, and what's the shape of the leaf, and is that fruit speckled or red or whatever. So all the time I'm using my past experience and photography to put it all together.
Going right back to the early days of Australia with Cook and Joseph Banks, there have been artists and drawers who specialise in drawing botanical images from life and animals as well. Does that interest you at all, to replicate the veins and the shapes of a leaf or not at all?
No, I'm too lazy. No, that's botanical drawing. That's incredibly accurate. I'm very quick, and all the images I create are recognisable, but if you look closely, they're a bit on the rough side. So, no.
Well, you call that creativity
well,
and distortion,
don't you? It's more... It's a little bit more impressionistic, but they're still recognisable.
I've also know, and I'm having seen exhibitions of yours, that when you do an exhibition, you often seem to do a series, that you seem to have an idea that you develop as a series rather than just a lot of... Some artists have an exhibition sort of random, and I don't mean random in any negative sense, but a lot of different images. Yes. You tend to follow a story or a series?
It's... Anne used to say, what's this about, an exhibition? I have an exhibition every year somewhere. And sometimes, if, as you suggest, they're a little bit hit and miss, some that style, some that content, it's not very cohesive. And so every time we had an exhibition, there would be a theme, and the theme would help it tie together. And so that meant it was quite an easy concept to sell. For example, the shearing shed one was all shearing sheds. And so when people came, they knew what they were going to get. It wasn't a bit of this, it wasn't a bit of this and a bit of that. And so I like to tie it together. For example, the one in Neeram was just this series of incredible still lifes with this dark background and bits and pieces stuck on it, which gave a story to it. Well, I thought it made, for me, it made a story. But I've always gone with a theme. So at the moment, I've got one coming up in Inverell in September, I think, or August or something. And it was going to be morning, noon and night. That's not working very well. So I'm still working it out as content, but that will evolve as the more I do.
You mentioned the word story just a moment ago. Do you like the concept of telling a story with your
own? Yes. It's interesting. When people come along, they say, oh, I like that, and they might buy it. But if they ask me why it is the way it is, I can tell them what's in my head. They often don't understand that. That's not the point. They enjoy it. They take it. But I want to have not just a still life with flowers, but stuff in it which is a story. I can remember one, I was doing Australiana with Banksias and Waratahs and stuff, and I was at that stage obsessed with wicker baskets. So all the wicker baskets in the painting, and the painting was an Australian flora, were all stuff which related to Australian early history. There was a demijohn woven in cane. There was a wool basket with wool spilling out of it, woven in cane. And so the notion was, this is how a lot of structures were made in the early days with I don't know where the cane came from, but it was they were very important. Well, they were very good structures. And then there was another one where I can't think of his name now. Anyhow, it's a billy with a cup in the top in his own little leather container. Mm-hmm. It was strapped to a saddle. It's a quart pot. That's right, it's a quart pot. And obviously it held a quart of water. So I was given this by my godmother years ago, and I've still got this thing. And so with this quart pot, its cup, which fits inside the billy, and its leather container, I then make a series of artworks which relate to the outback. So there's a camp oven there, there's dogs round the fire, there's corrugated iron, and there are flowers. And so this is, again, like the demijohn covered in cane. It was trying to say a lot more than just a bunch of flowers.
So you said something before, if people might know they like it but not know why, that you can tell a story which may or may not resonate with them. And in my background in film, we will sometimes talk about the interpretive community, meaning that we know the story we're trying to tell, and it's in another visual medium. We know what we're saying, yes. But then the people who buy it or like it or watch it, yes, they bring something else to it, don't they?
It's
and
very
they may create their own story.
Yes. Sometimes when you see artists whose work I find inaccessible, in other words, I've got no idea what I'm looking at, that's neither here nor there. But as soon as they start talking about it, it becomes alive.
Mm.
And that's really interesting. And so for me, I want that accessibility for lots of people, not just a few who might like a certain style.
The other thing I think we should touch on is the fact that you then found yourself back at TAS teaching art.
Yes, I was invited back to become an artist in residence by one of the headmasters, and I did that for a term. And at the stage, the school's history was being written, and my clever wife said, "Why don't to the author or to the guy who was writing the history, why don't you have artworks in there as well as photographs to make it more appealing?" And the author said, "Yeah, okay, we'll do that." And so the headmaster instigated an artist in residence. And so I was there for a term, and I researched all the history of all the buildings right from the very beginning. This is at TAS. And, of course, the original building was designed by John Sulman, as in the Archibald Sulman Prize people. And it was historically very important. But then over the years, as the school grew, more buildings were put up with associated memories and donors and the like. And so at the end of a term, I'd produced a huge body of work, which was then incorporated, some of them were incorporated into the history book. So from that experience, we went back to the farm. And then during that year, the director of studies suggested I might apply for an art job there at TAS. And I said, oh, no, I've never taught art. I couldn't do that. And Anne said, my wife said, well, what have you got to lose? And so I did apply. And they said, yep, your job. So without any qualifications. So initially I started off by teaching junior school art. Then I did 7-8 art. And then worked with the senior art teacher who was much more qualified than I was. But then during the course of time, the senior art teacher was there, had to leave, well, chose to leave. And they said, do you want to do senior art? And I said, oh, yeah, I'll have a crack at that. And so that's how it happened. So I became the art teacher, and I was there for 20 years. It was fantastic.
Did you, two questions come out of that. One is, did you get any particular satisfaction about passing on skills and technique and your understanding of art to others? Right. So I know some people do, others don't.
You never know, because students come along and come to your subject, they enjoyed it, and you never know how much they get from you until years later they'll come back and say, oh, I love this, I thought that was terrible. And so I enjoyed the company of the kids and getting them to do stuff they never realised they could. So this was when it was all boys, and a lot of the students I had, senior students I had then, were not necessarily great artists, though some were terrible. But what I was able to do was show, this is what you can do, give it a go, and manipulate their skills until they produce something. And they had a lovely time.
And the other, that's wonderful, I think, and that's probably all you can expect to do.
Yes, you have raw material, and you see, well, I'll see what I can do with it. And give it a go.
The other question that comes out of it, now that you're actually working, not on the farm, but in an environment where you're working with art, you're teaching art, you're thinking about every day, did that have an influence on your art practice? Did that help you?
It told me how much I didn't know.
Well, that's always a good starting point, isn't
so
it?
Instantly, I had to know how art history worked. And so I boned up on that very quickly. And so if a student said, what's happening here? I can't understand it. I have to say, well, this is probably why it is the way it is. It replicates what happened in history at the time. It might have been done at a cultural response. And so all of a sudden, I was having to read artworks, which I'd never seen before, because I had no art training, and give an answer to the student which made sense to them. So of course it affected me. I started taking a real interest in overseas art, exhibitions, contemporary art, modern art, Aboriginal art. And so all of a sudden I had to have knowledge enough to at least fool the kids to get away from it.
Do you think that changed your output?
I was much more aware of art, but I still produce the same. Well, no, my art's changed or changes all the time. But it probably did have some influence, yes. We've travelled a lot, and art's been a very interesting component of our travels. And so, yes, you see things, and it goes into context when you see it, and it probably does affect you, yeah.
So you're still painting, you're still in Armidale, and you say you're preparing for an exhibition in Inverell.
In Inverell, yes. So the Inverell Art Gallery have got me booked in up there, and so I'll have to, as in every exhibition I have, I usually end up with quite a lot of artworks. But I'm not quite sure yet what it's going to be.
So you can't give us an inside running on that as
it'll
yet.
It'll be terribly, terribly good.
Jane, that's wonderful. I've been speaking with James White, who's a resident of Armidale and is very well known in art circles here, has exhibited at NARAM a number of times, been involved in art, been involved in teaching, as he told us. And I found it quite fascinating to hear the journey from the farm at Bogabilla all the way through to travelling and working in watercolours and continuing to do so with great facility. So thank you very much for coming in and talking to us about this, James. It's been quite enjoyable.
More than happy to do it, Paul.
Thanks very much. Okay. You're listening to 2ARM, your local community radio station in Armidale.